Welcome, everybody. It is the Too High Podcast. I am in Cincinnati, Ohio. Deontay Lee is in, I was going to say Las Vegas, Nevada. Deontay Lee, you're in San Diego, California. D, what's going on?
Not much, man. Not much. I think, I wrote this in my likes and dislikes period piece, but this period of the year is probably like peak for football for me, right? You're getting close to like all the conference championship games on the college level, so we're going to get a lot of clarity on what's going to happen in the bowl season. And then at this point in the NFL year, you know, a lot of the contending teams, I think, are starting to separate themselves a little bit. And then some of those teams that are kind of like in that next tier in the conversation, they kind of start to break themselves up into which ones you can take seriously and which ones you can't. So, you know, it's a nice point of year for like a lot of clarity, and everything kind of moves downhill from this point on.
I will say it does feel like in the NFL that this is probably the least clear year. Usually I agree at this time of year, we know who can play and who can't play. This year does feel like a slight exception to that rule because everyone just keeps losing.
Right. I mean, but all these division races are still like within a game, two games of one another for the most part. So, yeah, we're going to get a lot of games that matter actually in the next couple of weeks. Yeah, I don't know how much we're going to be able to take away from these results because, like you said, a lot of these teams go on streaks and then they end up losing to teams that they shouldn't lose to. And it seems like we're always right back where we started, but we will get a lot of like high leverage, high importance games.
Speaking of high leverage, high importance, we have quite a few conference championships games to get to in a minute. But let's start with still have to kind of talk our way through all the coaching changes that are happening in college football.
That's right. So you have a head coach now.
That's right. This is hashtag CFB Talk presented by Manscaped. Manscaped just launched their new products, including their all new premium, ultra premium body wash and 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner. It's time to give yourself or someone who needs it the gift of beautiful skin and hair this holiday season. Go to manscaped.com and use promo code PFF for 20% off and free shipping. Inside the Performance Package 4.0 that you can get on the website, you'll find the signature Lawnmower 4.0. This electric trimmer has proprietary advanced skin-safe technology to reduce cuts on your skin. It's also waterproof, so you can use it in the shower. And there's an LED light on it. They also launched their 2-in-1 shampoo and conditioner, which has key ingredients, which with benefits that include hydrating, nourishing, and conditioning the scalp, plus strengthening your hair at the same time. Tis the season to load up on Manscaped products. So get yourself and whoever else in your family, in your friends list, the best gift of all, the Manscaped Performance Package 4.0. And so that's 20% off and free shipping with promo code Manscaped, promo code PFF at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com using promo code PFF. All right. Yes. LSU has a football coach and kind of off the board, even though, you know, on our podcast earlier this week, I did say like, yeah, whatever, Brian Kelly, sure.
Right.
So like, I'll start with the football stuff just to get that kind of out of the way, where I just feel like from a Brian Kelly perspective, I think this is a good move for him. Clearly he didn't feel like they could win a game in a semifinal and then a final against.
And I think that's true. I think that's true.
Against a Georgia, against a Clemson, against a against an Alabama, etc. So I guess going here where you go to a team that's won 3 national championships in the last 20 years, including 1-2 years ago, like, okay, that makes sense. From an LSU perspective, I look at it and I'm a little confused because Brian Kelly went in his first stop in Division I, he rebuilt Central Michigan, then he rebuilt Cincinnati, and then he rebuilt Notre Dame. That's not what's happening right now at LSU. Now, yes, okay, I get it. They haven't won a lot of games the last 2 years, but it's not a real rebuilding.
It's not a rebuild, right.
They have all the money in the world. This is just a... There's been weirdness the last 2 years, and they should get back on track just by virtue of the fact that they always recruit as good as anyone in the country, basically. Top of the tier 2 or maybe even low bottom tier 1 in terms of recruiting. So for me, it's like, all right, you want to bring in Brian Kelly. He's obviously had a lot of success wherever he's been, but this isn't a rebuild. So the staff becomes so much more important. This isn't okay. It's going to take us time. We're going to rebuild it in Brian Kelly's image. This is like, okay, we're trying to win the national championship in 2023. You know, January 2023, they want to win the national championship.
Right.
So the staff hires are super important in that sense. And we already know he's not bringing Marcus Freeman or Tommy Rees. As of right now, we don't know who the OC and DC are.
I was going to say, not only that, we really have no, there's no light being shed right now on who might be coordinators or really just the staff in general at this point.
Right. I it feels like they put a lot of, Brian Kelly put a lot of his eggs in the basket that he's going to get at least one of those two guys that were his coordinators the past few seasons at Notre Dame, and he doesn't get them. And so, you know, Brian Kelly has kind of changed his approach. He's become, like I think everyone else kind of has to do in college football, he's become that CEO head coach. He doesn't call plays anymore on offense or defense. He gave that to Tommy Rees. They've been really good. So, like, who's he bringing in? Because those two coordinators are going to win him the championship this year. Like, Brian Kelly might, you know, if it works out in the way that, you know, at the high end level, yeah, maybe they win two national championships in 5 years or something like that, which is possible. That might be on Brian Kelly to like create a program there and recruit well, whatever. But if they're going to try to win a national championship next season, it's on the coordinators. It's on them to put in a scheme that fits Max Johnson or whoever the quarterback is going to be, that fits the defensive players, that fits the offensive line. So that's where I'm a little like, okay, well, let's see who he brings in. Like if he goes and hires like Todd, like I wrote on Twitter yesterday, if he goes and hires like Todd Grantham, if he goes and hires like Will Muschamp, that's not super inspiring going forward. So that's where I'm a little like, I get it, and I also don't get it. I do think this was LSU being told no by some people behind the scenes, certainly Lincoln Riley, and then they're saying, who's the biggest name left? And we're just going to throw everything we can.
That is it. And the one thing I will say, you know, in Brian Kelly's defense, at least over the last like 4 to 5 years, he's done a pretty good job of identifying good coordinator candidates. Like obviously you had Mike Elko, and then Mike Elko was there for a year and goes to A&M. Like what can you do, right? Guy goes there, he does a good job, and then an SEC school comes and swoops him up, and then you get another defensive coordinator and Marcus Freeman behind him.
Well, that ends up Chris Clark
becoming Lee. And then Clark Lee, right, who goes on and becomes a head coach, and then Marcus Freeman who becomes a head coach, right? Like so, you know, on a certain level, it's like what can you do if you find guys that are good enough at their job and have enough of a profile that people also would see them, you know, taking SEC or just P5 level jobs, you know, head coach or coordinator. There's not much you can do. Now, I will say the Tommy Rees decision has to hurt for him. But even on that level, I'm sure, I mean, to a certain degree, I don't know if anybody should expect that one of Notre Dame's golden children would leave for LSU, right? Like that's probably an unfair expectation as well. But I am interested to see exactly where he leans, especially on the defensive end, because that was kind of the impetus for like a lot of the change at Notre Dame, was them fixing what they had defensively and being able to develop on that side of the ball. Obviously, you know, Brian Kelly may not have been the offensive play caller, but I think even for some of the, you know, philosophical changes that have happened, I trust that he'll be able to figure out a way to generate offense, right? And if you're at LSU, you're going to have the talent to be able to generate offense. And they're going to be returning some talented guys. And obviously, you know, we've talked a lot about what the talent pipeline is. To me, if they can nail the defensive coordinator hire the way that he did at Notre Dame, it would probably take a lot of the questions off the table for me. Because, you know, as you said, I mean, he's been successful basically everywhere he's gone, right? Like, and that is another piece of it. Regardless of how I might feel about the way that this whole process played out for LSU, they went and got a guy who has a strong resume, and that has a resume that if he goes to a place like this, you should have every expectation that they'll be able to compete for SEC championships within that 2 to 3 year window like you were explaining, right? So to me, yeah, it's about staff. Can you go get that defensive coordinator who can really take care of that side of the ball? And then from there, everything else is just about getting good players, right? Like, he's got to be able to get the players. He's in a situation where he can go get the players, and then just having that support staff around him to be able to handle all the small things.
Yeah, for sure. I've really liked that offense. I think that offense would work with Max Johnson. Obviously, you have to figure out if can you develop offensive linemen in one offseason. That's really going to be And we talked about this on Monday, why I was so excited for whether it was going to be Billy Napier or Lincoln Riley, Brian right. Kelly, was because these guys have all developed offensive linemen, which LSU sorely needs right now. Mm-hmm. Can he do that in one offseason? Because I think you're going to get a quarterback that's going to go into his third year. You're going to get a receiving core. Kishan Butte is going to be back. There's some obviously really good receivers there. So if you can create an offense where you can mash them a bit, call play action, give Mac Johnson some easy layup throws, then the offense can start clicking right away. Finding these offensive linemen or developing them this offseason, I think is going to be it's priority number one, I think, offensively for sure. And I don't think it's anything close, to tell you the truth. I know a lot of LSU fans are not a big fan of Mac Johnson. I do think, let me see what he looks like when he's not playing in an air raid offense. Doesn't give him any favors, but so I think when you look at these quarterbacks that Brian Kelly's had over the years,
I was going to say, if he made it work with Ian Book, dude, then
that's literally what I was about to say.
Perfectly fine about what Johnson will be like in his offense.
Yeah, so I think, again, the coordinator hires are super important, but all right, let's move on. I just want to say this one thing, because I say this a lot, and I don't say it like in public a lot, but I just feel this way. Felt this way for a long time. Since I've been coaching and whatever, there's a lot of good people out there who should be considered for these jobs.
Yes.
And we seems like we keep hiring, man, I don't want to get in trouble here, but it seems like we keep hiring bad people for these jobs.
It's very difficult for people who are in it for the best reasons. I hate doing the right, wrong reasons, but I'll say the people who are in it for the best reasons, it does sometimes feel like they have the most difficult time breaking through. I think that's part of it. And if I'm going to be fair and give those people agency as well, I do think that a lot of the people who are in this for the best reasons are also very selective about the kind of environments that they decide that they're going to be a part of. And I think that ends up shrinking the market for a lot of these guys as well. Right now, this sport is obviously going through its another metamorphosis with the way the money's being thrown around in the coaching market, and the way that this new SEC realignment, right? I don't want to say realignment in general, because I think a lot of this revolves around the decision that Oklahoma and Texas made with a lot of this stuff. What that is doing for the context of the sport as well. If you listen to Split Zone Duo, which I'm pretty sure, there's got to be a decent amount of crossover between their audience and ours, especially on the college football side. I'm sure you guys have heard those conversations about autonomy, on the horizon. And, there's already conversations about the playoff expansion, and that's going to introduce another level, corporatism and big money conversations happening in the sport. And it's just not, for as much as I hate to sound like a curmudgeon, it's not the sport that I grew up with or you grew up with. And so it for damn sure isn't the sport that my father and his father grew up with anymore. So, for that reason, I do think that we have to be mindful of the fact that a lot of these conversations are just kind of colored by what the economy of this sport is. It's not really about the game anymore. And I was talking about this with our friend Justice, right? Like, the head coach is the head of the marketing firm of a university. And a university right now, as far as the athletics goes, is a $1 billion corporation or part of a multi-billion-dollar corporation. And that does change the calculus for just about everybody. And unfortunately, in multi-billion-dollar industries, it's difficult for some of the greatest people to end up punching through and really kind of leaving the impact that I think that they deserve to.
Yeah, I mean, that's I think that's pretty well said. Thoughts quickly on Joe Moorhead, Oregon offensive coordinator, going to Akron to be the head coach?
I'm surprised that Akron is a landing spot. I'm not surprised that he's taking a head coaching job, and I'm definitely not surprised that he's taking a head coaching job in the Midwest. I am very surprised that it's a MAC school.
Yeah.
I don't know what that says about his tenure in Oregon. And I don't know what that says about, like, I have a hard time believing, given his reputation, especially while he was at Penn State, and what he's done at Oregon, that, like, whatever failings may have happened at Mississippi State was a stain on his resume to the point that he couldn't have gotten another P5 or near P5, high level G5 head coaching offer. So I'm going to guess, until I see like a press conference and kind of get a better feel for, what the market was for him, whether or not this was just a decision for him to just get back to his Midwestern roots and try to build something up from there. But I have to believe that there was a bigger market for him. And if there wasn't, I'm confused as to why that was.
I agree 100%. I think we both really like Joe Moorhead and what he does on offense. And I don't think that Mississippi State tenure is fair to him, because I don't know how they were ever going to replicate what Dan Mullen did there. Like, we talk about Mississippi State in a different way that in 2021 than we did in 2011, right? Like, Dan Mullen built that program up. It was always going to be tough to sustain it once he left. So yeah, and I think he's a hell of a coach, and I don't really understand him going to the MAC. Maybe there was issues at Oregon. Maybe he just didn't want to be there anymore, and like, he just took the first job available.
That's kind of, I didn't want to have to put it that way, but the way that this played out just leads me to believe that maybe there was something going on with his relationship with Mario Cristobal, and if not Cristobal, just being at Oregon in general, that made him feel like he had to get away.
Steve Adazio fired from Colorado State. Is he going to be the next LSU offensive coordinator?
If I were you, I wouldn't even put that in the air, man.
Yeah, that's that would be something. Am I missing anyone? I didn't write this down. I feel like that's.
I don't think that there are any new big developments at this point in time. Not to say that the way that this is going, not to say that something can't break within the next 8 minutes. You know.
Yeah. Right. Well, I'll finish by asking you. Now you're 3 days, I guess, into the Lincoln Riley era of your USC Trojans. Mm-hmm. You feeling good?
Feeling good, man. Feeling good. I mean, we'll see what early signing day looks like. You know, finally, that obviously, the way that the sport is set up now with early signing day, like, that is kind of like a declarative statement on the momentum of your program. So right now, you know, with a lot of these decommitments happening at Oklahoma, and, you know, there's going to be a little bit of flux because the interim head coach at USC was also their lead recruiter, in Dante Williams, and he brought in, you know, a lot of his own guys. So their stats, some of the commitments and whether or not guys are going to enter the transfer portal, that's all kind of up in the air as well. And you always see that when a coaching change happens, right? Like, there's typically a pretty big exodus for guys who are on the roster already, some guys who are in the recruiting class, and then they're kind of swapped out, you know, whether it's transfers coming from that new coach's old school or people who are just kind of attracted to, you know, the new shiny thing in the store. And then obviously, you know, his own recruits in the class as well. So I am feeling good about the fact that they've hit recruiting hard. I am still interested to see what this defense looks like under Alex Grinch, because this is, I think, the third now philosophical change that they've made in maybe 4 or 5 seasons between Clancy Pendergast, Todd Orlando, and now Alex Grinch. So I'm interested to see what that's like. But he has been good with defensive line guys. And to me, if you're good in the trenches at USC, that to me is the key to being a national title contending type of program. When they've been their best, they had NFL caliber talent, both on offensive and defensive line. And that's what they've got to be able to get back to more than anything about the air raid or whatever else, you know, the conversation may be.
All right, let's move into the conference championship games, especially the ones that affect the college football playoff. We'll start with the SEC championship game. We're finally getting the matchup that we think we all thought was going to happen, honestly, from week one.
Basically, yeah.
It's, and honestly, if Georgia would have lost to Clemson in week one, it probably wouldn't matter,
yeah,
right?
Yeah. Honestly, this game would probably have more magnitude if they had.
Yep. So we're getting the undefeated Georgia. We're getting one loss, Alabama. Alabama coming off a 4-overtime victory in the Iron Bowl. Anyways, your thoughts on the SEC Championship game?
I think there are 3 key matchups. 2 of them, you know, I wanted to look at some data to pull from. You know, I think that the one thing the Auburn game really kind of revealed is that Alabama is having some trouble up front, both with protecting his quarterback and with creating lanes in the run game. But one thing that I found interesting is that Georgia has also struggled against pressure. Now, obviously, they've done such a great job of controlling the flow of games that it has not been a big issue, and they honestly haven't even faced a ton of pressure this year. Like, right now, I think we have them at 64 dropbacks, which over, what, a 12-13-game sample is pretty low, right? That's pretty low. But what I will say is that in their dropbacks where they've seen pressure, they've got a 34% completion rate, and there are more sacks, scrambles, and interceptions than they've had completions. You know, and obviously, you know, one thing that we do know over Stetson Bennett's career is that he's always kind of good for throwing the ball up into situations where he does not need to, especially when there's pressure involved. And knowing what Alabama has in Will Anderson, who I think has a legitimate chance to be a Heisman winner this year. You know, they've got a 49% pressure rate this year, Alabama does. 11% of the time it's unblocked, and, you know, almost a quarter of the time it's in less than 2.5 seconds. So if they're able to generate that kind of pressure, that to me is going to be their easiest avenue into being able to control the game on the defensive end of the ball. That was the first thing I looked at. And then the second one is just going to be Alabama's receivers against UGA's DBs, right? Like, how does that match up? You know, can Georgia play tight coverage against Alabama's receivers and make it difficult on Bryce Young that way? When I looked at how Alabama has performed against man, not only are they getting 16.2 yards per catch, they're averaging 9 yards in yak per reception. So not only are they, you know, able to find their way into getting catches, and I think they have like a 14% contested catch rate, which also says that even if you're playing man, you're not actually playing tight coverage on their receivers because they're so talented. And they're able to, you know, get separation both before and after the catch. So that makes them really dangerous. And then obviously one thing that we know about Kirby Smart and Dan Lanning in this defense is they're at their best when they want to play tight coverage. This year so far, they have like a 53% completion rate, 6 interceptions and 10 forced incompletions, and a 70% success rate in man coverage. So that to me is where the game is really going to be kind of decided. Can Georgia keep Stetson Bennett clean? You know, if not, are they going to go to JT Daniels? And then can they keep JT Daniels clean? Or is he going to be able to create offense? And then when Bryce Young has the ball, will he be able to trust his receivers to be able to work their way open against man coverage? And can Georgia be able to squeeze those windows shut? And that, to me, is kind of what's going to decide the game.
I kept thinking throughout this past, you know, 2 months or something, knowing that we were going to get this game, I kept thinking about the Alabama offense versus Georgia defense matchup, being like, you know, Georgia's not very, I mean, so Georgia's like elite on defense, but, you know, Alabama always finds ways to score on this team. Mm-hmm. And I was like, it might happen again. But then every week, I just keep thinking, I don't know, man.
I don't know.
And the Auburn game, I can't get it out of my head. I mean, obviously it just happened, but I can't get it out of my head because we know what Auburn is. This year on defense, under defensive coordinator Derek Mason, they are a show you cover one and play cover one team. Press.
Yes, sir.
And
yes, sir.
Alabama had massive, massive trouble. And we know they didn't score a bunch of points. I mean, they were held scoreless for three quarters. The only touchdown they scored was the last play of the fourth quarter, right? So,
right.
So that scares me a lot because I think Auburn's a really, really good football team on defense. They have a really right. elite defensive line, and they have Roger McCreary is a really good corner. So they have players there. Georgia is better, mm-hmm. but probably not even. But Auburn is really, really good. So when I looked at that tape, I'm like, okay, first of all, Alabama can't block anybody.
Yep.
Especially on the right side, couldn't block nobody. That's a problem.
Yeah.
And I didn't love the game plan by Bill O'Brien because. I'll give him the benefit of the doubt, which is that every time Alabama's played for the past 2 years, you can just call all these deep shots and they just work.
Yeah.
So you're going to the game saying, oh, I got a bunch of man coverage. I got a bunch of press man coverage. Now, if I see press man and early in the game, I'm trying to score touchdowns, right?
Absolutely.
I'm trying to hit big plays.
Yeah.
Like, I get
Absolutely.
It. Absolutely. But like for them to not really have a backup plan to say, hey, maybe we can get into more condensed formations and create stacks and bunches, which we know Sark did a lot of, and Bill O'Brien does not do.
And what else that allows you to do? It allows you to run the ball really well out of spread. And that's something else that that was the thing that really kind of set off the alarm bells for me in that Auburn game. There was like a point in the third quarter where I think CBS had put up the graphic and Alabama had like 3 yards rushing. Yeah. On the day at that point, at least at that point in the game. And I think they finished with like 70 or 82 yards or something to that effect. To me, that's the big red flag. That's how you end up putting Bryce Young in a situation
yep.
where it's 3rd and 9. And now Dan Lanning can call all of those exotic looks where, you know, they're really putting stress on one side of the line the way the Texas A&M did and playing tight coverage, even though you're only rushing 4, you're able to generate that pressure. That to me is a big, big issue for me with Alabama. Now, given that, to your point, styles do make fights, and Alabama is good at moving the ball through the air for the most part. And I think that, you know, the one thing we saw in that last drive in order to tie the game up was if you give Bryce Young enough looks at man,
yeah.
he will find his way to cut it up. You know, all you got to do is get him the time, right? That's all it is. If you get the guy the time, and we've been saying this since the Miami game, right? This guy's got elite level poise for a young quarterback and elite level ball placement for a young quarterback. So I am interested to see kind of, you know, what the game situations, what do those first and second downs look like? Because if they end up in long third down scenarios, it's almost not going to matter unless Bryce Young is absolutely unconscious. So that to me, I think, you know, that's going to be the really big thing, you know, to kind of piggyback off of what you were saying.
Yeah. So I like I said, I still have a little weird taste in my mouth from that Auburn game because they should have scored. I mean, like, as good as Auburn is on defense, this is Alabama. Like, you got to.
Yeah, this is Bama.
You gotta score points, man. And they didn't score any points, and that scares me a lot. And it's like, you know, Georgia. The difference between Georgia and Alabama, both of them, like you say, want to play tight coverage. But Auburn is a, like I said, show you press man and play man.
Play press man. Yep.
But Georgia's different. Georgia has no problem playing in light boxes, playing with two high safeties, rotating down late. That, you know, like, you might not get these opportunities that Bryce Young had late in that game. Mm-hmm. On that game tying touchdown drive. We talked about this before. I thought that when I was watching the game live that Derek Mason was still playing a lot of cover one on that last drive. Turns out he did switch it up a bit. But the big difference was they were getting pressure all game. They were getting to Bryce Young, sacking him. He was able to escape.
Right.
So I think if you can do that, like you said, if he can escape and make plays, then they're still in a game. But if he's getting pressure and it's the type of pressure where he's got nowhere to go, he's got to go down, that's obvious. I mean, that's obviously, I'm not saying anything crazy here, but like.
Right. I don't have to say it. Well, I guess we're not breaking football wide open here, right? You affect the quarterback, you affect the game. But that is what ultimately, you know, that is basically all I'm looking at in this game. Everything else, I think Alabama and Georgia can play themselves basically even based on their talent levels. It's what happens with the pockets for both of these quarterbacks.
Yep, I think so.
That's going to, you know, make or break really what the margin in this game is. Because I think, you know, blind draw, I'm probably gonna pick a team in Georgia's position to win this game, you know, 8 or 9 out of 10 times. It just comes down to those small little marginal situations.
Yeah, and the line, I mean, 6.5 points. Alabama, an underdog.
I was to say an Alabama 6.5 points.
Oh boy. Man. That's juicy, man, for me. Yeah. Like, I think Georgia's a better team, like you said, but 6.5 points is a lot of points for Alabama.
For Bama, yeah, this is Bama.
Who scored 41
about.
Points on Georgia last year. Different mm-hmm. offense, I understand that. Different coordinator, blah, blah, blah. Just, like, let's not forget saying, that happened
styles.
Last year.
It's all styles.
Yeah. Anyways, if they can protect him, which is, I don't get no guarantee, but if they can protect Bryce Young, they're going to score points.
100%.
A lot of points. All right, let's move on to the Big 12 title game. I think the game is in Dallas. Baylor rematch versus Oklahoma State. I believe the line is 5.5 towards Oklahoma State, which makes sense to me. Anyways, your thoughts on this one?
I think it's just going to come down to whether or not Baylor can shake loose and find some space with their outside zone game. That was the one thing they could not do to save their lives against Oklahoma State the first time. And obviously we know that they don't have a pass. I don't know how else to say it. They just don't have enough of a passing game to be able to generate offense if they don't have their fastball and their outside zone stuff. Yeah. And to me, I think that their passing game has almost kind of regressed in a lot of ways over the course of the year. Because teams, I think, are playing tighter and tighter to receivers with the understanding that their quarterback can't beat them over the top anyways, and they're not looking to play over the top. So that's the game for me. You know, they've averaged 6 yards per carry on outside zone this year, Baylor has. And Oklahoma State, they've done a pretty good job of stuffing some of these runs. They give up 5.5 yards, but, I mean, you're really not going to see teams hold an outside zone scheme to, like, you know, 3 or 2.5 yards per carry unless you're just talking about ridiculous talent on the inside.
Well, but I would say that is what happened in the
and
first
exactly,
game.
Exactly. And that's, to me, and a lot of that is because Baylor just could not win, you know, their one-on-one blocks. They could not get the edge to save their lives either. And they were really able to kind of crush a lot of those alleyways that Baylor has had. So to me, I think a lot of it is going to come down to Bohannon as a runner. you know, more than anything. Like, can you just make it a designed QB run instead of it just being regular old outside zone? Maybe you do what you did against Oklahoma and just get into like offset gun, give the guy the snap, and it's basically single wing, and we're just running lead, you know, behind the tight end and the running back. That to me, I think, would probably be a big piece of what they want to do on offense. You know, and not too dissimilar to the SEC championship game. In almost every other way, these two teams are kind of looking eye to eye. They're basically even. But the fact that Baylor couldn't move the ball on the ground is what really kind of allowed the game to get away from them the first time these teams played.
I thought that a couple things that Oklahoma State was able to do with their Baylor, would you say they have wider splits than you would have thought?
Yes.
I noticed that.
Yes, for an outside zone team, yes. But I felt we said the same thing about BYU last year, right?
Yeah.
So I guess that's kind of his thing. That's kind of his deal.
So what does that mean, right? It means you're getting a lot of one-on-one blocks. Yeah. And they were getting pushed back, you know, whether it was a tackle or the guards or the center, they were getting pushed back a lot. And we talked about what zone teams hate, or especially outside zone teams, they hate penetration.
Yep.
Because it stops the running back in his track, and then he's got to cut it back early, you know, he's got to bounce it early or whatever it is, and that happened time and time again. And one of the things I noticed was, I don't even know if it was called slants by the defensive line or it just so happened because of that fast outside zone movement by the offense, but what was happening was you'd have, like, let's say a defensive end in the C gap. The ball would be snapped and the run would be coming to his side. He would redirect back into the B gap, and not like a heavy technique where he's taking on the blocker and then working his way inside. He was just like almost slanting back in the B gap, and he was slamming on that guard, and that guard was taking the knock 3 yards back in the backfield. And then again, that's penetration, and you can't have that. Right. And I think they were able to play in a light box. They do a lot of three high safety stuff, which allows them, okay, you're in a light box. It allows them to play the boot when it happens, because you can have a player outside on the quarterback and the slide route or the flat route. And this team, Oklahoma, Baylor, did not have any changeups. Now, what we like, you could condense your splits a little more. If you want to run the zone, maybe condense your splits a little more and just deal with some of that movement post snap.
So it's just easier to pick that stuff up.
Easier to pick it up. You could come with some counter. You could come with some power trap. I don't know. Like, do you want to put that stuff in this late in the season? Because they really don't.
Yeah, especially when it's not your identity.
They don't do shit all. But
it is. It is outside zone until they're blue in the face.
Yeah. So. That to me is tough, and like you said, I don't think Bohannon, and even if it's like the backup who played last week, Shepin, like, you can't just drop back and throw the football.
No,
not this team. The Oklahoma defense is way too good at that. Well, so this matchup scares me to death if I'm a Baylor Bears fan, and honestly, I am a Baylor Bears fan. So I don't love the matchup. 5.5 points. I would definitely take Oklahoma State minus 5.5. If they keep doing the same thing, I just don't see how they can run the football against this team, and then they can't do anything.
Yeah, I was gonna say. I mean, had the game gone even like 5% different for Baylor running the football, I might feel like, everything else I thought they looked pretty good with, I think they can win the game. But the way it was, the manner in which they got their asses kicked up front, that made me feel like, oh, this might actually be a bigger issue than even I had originally thought. You know, so that to me is a big, really big deal. And yeah, I'm not entirely positive that we'll get a much different result this time around than we saw when they played about a month or so ago.
Yeah. It was 24-0, really. That when I look at the game, it was like a 24-0 game that ended up 24-14.
24-14, yeah.
So it's rough. All right, moving on to Indianapolis for the Big Ten championship game. We have Michigan and Iowa. Spread, I believe, is 10.5 towards Michigan. This is another huge spread where it's like, yeah, I think Michigan is like the better team. I don't think there's any anywhere close. But 10.5 points in what could be a low scoring game.
I was going to say, like, if somebody, I don't know who this person is that I'm just marketing this to, but if there is a football fan out there who wants to see a 17-13 conference championship game, this is probably what you're going to get. And it's not because, at least on Michigan's side, it's not because they're incapable of moving the football. Again, it just comes down to the style of play. Both of these teams are so comfortable, you know, press corners. We're going to play our safeties low, close to the box. We're going to load it up and take away the run. And you're going to have to beat one-on-one coverage out on the perimeter because we're flooding the middle of the field when you do pass.
Yeah.
And, you know, in order to beat that. Now, the one thing I will say that is interesting in terms of matchups is Michigan's wide receivers against Iowa's DBs. Iowa's DBs obviously performed relatively well against Penn State, but Penn State was down their quarterback. So that was honestly, you know, not the greatest data point to use as something that's going to be predictive for Michigan. But
plus,
I am
only getting one. Like, Hankins is out. Moss is good, but Hankins is out.
Exactly. So I am interested to see, you know, when they are in passing situations, whether or not Michigan is willing and able, you know, to allow their quarterback to take those shots down the field. And if they do, if they can win enough of those one-on-ones to be able to open the score up. But if not, this is going to be the fastest conference championship game of the weekend, I can tell you that. Okay, the clock is going to stay rolling.
Yeah, I think Iowa has a chance to stop the run.
Yes.
And then it's going to fall on Cade McNamara, who we both like, but we don't know if he can do it in this type of situation, if a running game is not working for them. I think this is potentially a better run-stopping unit than Ohio State. Now, Iowa's run-stopping unit potentially better than Ohio State, or at least equal, but maybe, this, like you said, the style makes the matchup, so potential there. Michigan, the other problem is, like, when you flip it and you talk about Iowa's offense, they're not going to score. Like, that's the problem. They're not going to score. So, like, Iowa at 10 points, I can't see them over like 14 or something like that, 17 maybe.
If they get to 17, yeah, they probably got like a sack strip or a pick six. Honestly, it's going to be rough. It's going to be a rough football game. It's going to be a whole lot of running on first and second down and then throwing screens on third down.
Yeah, I that's what I see. I don't know if they can. The offensive line is good. Obviously, you have the interior unit with Linderbaum and I've got the guard's name, Britt, I think his name is, are pretty good. But
I mean,
it's tough.
Dude, their pass rush. I mean, after looking at what their pass rush did last weekend, man.
Yeah, oof. I know.
I mean, I'm kind of getting to the point where I'm really excited to see. You know, obviously, assuming that they win, I'm excited to see who Michigan matches up with in the semifinal, because they're going to be a tough out for a lot of teams because of what they're able to do with their pass rush up front.
Yep, 100%. Yeah, I don't see Iowa scoring enough points. Like I said, 10.5 is a lot because I think there's a universe out there where Iowa's defense makes some plays, but I can't see a world where Iowa wins the game.
No.
Yeah. We can get to the AAC game, Cincinnati versus Houston. I don't know a ton about Houston, but obviously that's a huge game. I think with Cincinnati, it's just like, just win it. You know, it's no more style points. You're in it if you win it. So I don't really care how they do it. I just think they're probably the better team. But Houston seems pretty good to me, to tell you the truth, for a Group of Five team.
Mm-hmm.
All right, let's change gears here for a minute, and let's go into the NFL. We wanted to talk about something that has been popping up this week, talking about the Dolphins' offense, Tua Tagovailoa. They're winning some games now. They lost some games without Tua. When he's been in there, they are winning games. But when you kind of look at it, how sustainable is the offense that they're running with Tua at quarterback, running all these RPOs? I wrote an article about it a month ago, being like, so at that time, the Dolphins were going to finish like, you know, bottom five in the league. And I was like, just right, let them drop back and see what you have, because you just don't know. And now they're winning games. They're kind of back in the race here in the AFC for the wild card. They're doing it with a ton of RPOs. What's your take here?
I will say that the thing that I probably have the most difficulty with contextualizing with the Dolphins is because their RPOs just aren't the same as everybody else's.
Yeah.
And this is something that we talk about, you know, all the time. You know, is it not all of them are created equally? So basically, like, you have to be able to kind of branch out and consider each one of these. Each kind of style of RPO is its own deal, right? So, like, Miami, they run slants. That's their thing. They run a ton of slants with their RPOs. If you look at a team like Pittsburgh, they like throwing speed outs versus off coverage. That's their deal with RPOs. You know, if you take a team like the Packers, yep, they really like throwing bubbles, you know, with their RPOs. That's yep, their, that's one of their big deals. The Colts, so which, I wrote about it.
So, yeah, Colts with the stick.
With the stick concept, you know, they're just...
Which, out of those four, so you have the Colts running the stick, you have Dolphins running slant and glance, you have Packers running bubble, and you have Steelers, among many teams, running the speed out to the ISO receiver. Who can get the biggest plays, just schematically?
I mean, literally by geometrically, it's the Dolphins. It's because they run their routes the furthest down the field.
That's it.
That's really, I mean, it's really as simple as that. Now, I mean, their offense looks better when they are able to generate those longer gains because they're doing that on first and second down, right? So they're avoiding the situations where you're putting Tua in harm's way most, which would be those obvious, you know, third and long, second and forever plays. And it's been a good way for them to avoid the fact that they just cannot run the football to save their lives either. So it's, I'm not here necessarily to litigate whether or not it's a good play call. If the play call works, then it's a good play call. I'm not 100% angry at that. Nope. It's just like, let's make sure that we hold this kind of stuff in its proper context, because as defenses adjust, like if they play a team that really is comfortable saying like, hey dude, we'll play two man on first down and take this stuff away. We'll play bracket on first and second down and take this stuff away and really force you to hand the football off. That changes the math for them. Because they're such a spread team, teams kind of deal with them a little in odd ways, in my opinion. I don't know how much longer they're just going to see like soft cover three or cover one, you know, or even soft quarters. I do think that teams will continue to play tighter and tighter coverage on them, especially on early downs, or change their coverage shells in general against this team. You know, just like how we talk about with the Ravens, right? You can't defend the Ravens like you defend the Browns, even though they both run the ball a lot. It's not the same kind of runs, right? It's a different style of fitting the run. And the same thing will eventually happen with the Dolphins. I mean, right now it's great. You know, Tua looks good when all this stuff is going well. I do think that the conversation about him being the best RPO throwing quarterback is kind of odd to this conversation that we're having, because I don't know what that means if everybody runs different RPOs. You know, like, I guess that's like saying that, you know, a basketball player is the best 15-foot mid-range shooter and not the 19-foot mid-range shooter guy. You know, that to me is where it gets a little funny. But it's been working fine, you know, for the last like month or so. What's kind of your take on, you know, how these things kind of divide up and how we should be thinking about, you know, RPOs in that context?
Yeah, I mean, no, I'm with you 100%. I mean, I think that it's, I get why you could call him, if you look at the stats, call him the best RPO quarterback, because he's averaging, I think on our data, it's somewhere between like 9 and 9.5 yards per attempt on RPO throws. But again, it's like, well, what type of throws are these? It's always the same thing. Like, what we have to look in within the context of RPOs. So, and it's not even just like what type of throws, it's are you making the right decisions? Like, no one. Exactly. Now, I will say that, like, I think quarterbacks tend to give the ball more than they should on RPOs, especially when, I mean, we talked about this a few weeks ago, like watching Josh Allen, like in 2020, when he would like pull the ball on a slant RPO and wait for the receiver to get in the second window on an RPO. Mm-hmm. You could just do that. Like, just might as well just pull the ball every time. But like, anyways, so there's so much more with what it means to be an RPO thrower, and everything gets charted as an RPO, whether it's a post-snap RPO, like the Dolphins run with the slants and stuff, like trying to think, I guess the Eagles in their Super Bowl year were doing that stuff, I guess.
Yep. I've seen the Chiefs do it as Chiefs, well, where they kind of run, yep, that slide route, so it looks almost, yep, like a bootleg.
Compared to what most NFL quarterbacks are doing, which is pre-snap RPO. Even if you, like Rodgers for sure, in the bubbles, even the ones where we talk about Ben Roethlisberger throwing that speed out, even though he puts the ball in the gut, to me, that's still a pre-snap RPO. It's a free access ISO receiver, pre-snap RPO, and it's completely different than what the Dolphins are doing. And good on the Dolphins for finding this. Like, good on the Dolphins for saying...
Exactly.
This is how we do it. Now,
Just saying, screw it. We don't need to run any other offense except for this. Like, there's value in that.
Yes, 100%. And it's working for them. And, like, the other thing that I push back against is also the, well, he did it at Alabama, so they knew he was going to be good at it. And it's like, again, like... most quarterbacks would be good at this stuff. Right. It's not; they're not the most difficult reads in the world. You're reading one defender, a key read, and I've said this before. You know, if you compare it to like quick game, you know, you get in a slant flat versus slant RPO. It's a lot easier to say, "Oh, I don't like this slant route. I'm just going to give the ball," rather than, "Oh, I don't like this slant route. Let me reset my feet for the flat." Or let me reset my feed for the second slant or whatever, because I don't have the option to hand the ball off. Like, that's a lot easier, man. Like, so, like, yeah, there's definitely, I think me and you are both on the same page about the pushback on, like, what it means to be the best RPO thrower, whether you can be the best RPO thrower, whether we even have enough sample size of anyone running it for us to have this discussion. Because, the only team running this in the NFL
the corollary I would draw. Would you have called Jared Goff the best play action thrower of all time in 2018?
Right, exactly.
You would not, because not everybody was running play action that way. Not everybody's offense is designed that way. It's the same kind of conversation.
If Aaron Rodgers was in the Dolphins offense, like, they would be even better. Like, he would be the best RPO thrower.
The dude would have like an 85% completion rate on every season.
With crazy yak.
Exactly. If this was Devontae Adams running glances, dude, could you imagine what those numbers would look like? So, you know, that's just kind of where I'm at with it. Like, good on them. I'm glad it's working. I hope it works. Because it's just enough to me. All that is just introducing a new layer of functional offense, right? Which makes it possible for more quarterbacks to play, you know, effectively and longer in the NFL. I'm never mad at that. But yeah, let's just make sure that we put these things in their proper buckets. Okay, all this dude is doing is throwing in the air for a lot of these throws because space is being vacated. To me, that is not necessarily a indicator of somebody's quality as a quarterback. And we probably should not try to find, you know, these weird delineations on what makes the best or worst of an RPO thrower. Because I think just about every NFL quarterback is capable of throwing a quick game concept. It's not the way that we shouldn't be talking about it the way that people are. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, and you can even make the argument. I don't want to shit on Tua too much, but you can even make the argument that he doesn't have the quickest release. Like, when you're talking about, like, RPOs, it's about, like, getting the ball out as quickly as possible, you know, from the ball in the running back's gut to the ball in the air. He's not like he has, like, this insanely quick release, you know what I mean? So there's got to be better quarterbacks if they were given the chance. My other issue with the Dolphins' offense is, like, when they drop back, they don't throw the ball down the field either. So it's like, explosive plays besides catch and runs by some of your talented receivers?
And eventually, dude, it's going to get taken away. And when it does, what is the counterpunch going to be? Because it's not readily apparent to me. It's never the breakout thing that makes an offense, right? It's always what's the counterpunch so that way your breakout thing can stay viable and teams can't just sit on what you want to do the most.
All right, that was our favorite weekly segment called Which Quarterback is Going to Be the Next Mitchell Trubisky 2018, presented by Western and Southern. Whether it's football success or financial savvy, the right questions help set the stage for winning strategies. Western and Southern is teaming up with PFF's very own Chris Collinsworth to share insights that can help put you ahead on both your fantasy and financial scoreboards. Want to hear about Chris's old playing days or behind the scenes with Al on Sunday Night Football? How about a need to know for your financial future? Now you can ask about either or both. And every football or financial question you ask earns you a chance to win a catered party for February's big game. Check out the Chris Collinsworth podcast and Western and Southern's Instagram for answers to the best questions each week. Submit your questions at westernsouthern.com/askchris. One more time, that is westernsouthern.com/askchris. If you're watching on YouTube, check out the link in the description below. Remember, with Western and Southern, you can rest assured on game day. All right, let's finish it out with a pretty important Sunday Night Football game. Kansas City at Denver. We don't need to talk too much. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about, you know, the Denver offense that's playing okay-ish.
Yes.
A very uninspiring offense, I find. When I watched it on tape, I was like, Is it? Like, it sound, I got no problem with that. They just kind of like don't do a lot. And Teddy checks the ball down a lot. And I think if Teddy wanted to throw the ball more, you see when he does throw the ball down the field a bit more, he's accurate. He throws some really nice crossing routes down the field. He's going to continue to be Teddy. So you have any thoughts on that side of the ball?
I mean, when he doesn't, it looks better. I think that early in the year, a lot of the turnovers and stuff was really creating some issues for this team. You know, if they're cleaner with the football, it looks a little bit better. But to your point, I mean, it's uninspiring, especially when I look at like what this receiver room looks like when it's healthy and everybody's available. You know, I'm like, you can do a lot with their complement, you know, with a lot of their complementary pieces. You have a tight end who we know can create a lot of offense after the catch. You know, is a tough runner, he's got good hands. They have basically a guy for every role as a wide receiver. I like their running backs, you know, now that they went out and drafted a guy that I really like, Javonte Williams. They can create a lot of interesting issues for defenses, I think, when they get it all humming. It's just sometimes, and I don't want to put it all on Teddy, right, because he is who he is. I can't be but so shocked that a quarterback that I've been watching for however long is still playing the same way that he's been playing. Like, it's not on him, it's on me if I thought that it was going to be something different. But to that point, like, I don't know. I mean, I don't think enough of what this team is offensively to tell you that like anybody should feel particularly encouraged, especially given the fact that Kansas City looks like its head is out of its ass on defense, you know, at least for the time being.
All right, so let's flip it over. We're getting the Kansas City offense versus the Fangio defense, something that I think we've been wanting to see for quite a while. How do you think this plays out?
I can tell you how it won't play out, like it did when it was Bradley and the Raiders the last time that the Chiefs were on Sunday Night Football. I can guarantee you that. But again, this is going to be yet another referendum, I think, on everybody's narrative on whether or not this offense can handle, you know, a defense that's going to play with a lot more split safety looks. What I'm really interested to see is whether or not Kansas City can run the ball the way that they did against Philadelphia earlier in the year. Now, obviously, Denver's defense is better than the Eagles' defense. I will say that much. Definitely more talented. But the one thing that I saw in that game when I went back and watched it was a commitment to running the football when they saw too high. And then being able to get a team into single high shells. And again, this is something that we've talked about with Kansas City. You can play cover three against them. It's just a very particular way that you play cover three against them. It has to be a lot softer with your underneath droppers because their slots can be so vertical. And that's really where they're able to try to manipulate, you know, what's happening at that second level between linebackers and safeties. So to me, that's kind of what I'm looking at, is whether or not there's going to be enough of a commitment. Can you really mash teams? Is this going to be a week, or I think it kind of needs to be a week, where there's less of Travis Kelce go split out and be the X wide receiver, and more of I need you as a real tight end right now to help us create an extra gap or add to the surface and really get downhill on this team. And then once we get them rolling down, then we can start using motion, you know, and some of the other creative ways that they're able to dial up their RPOs and their play action game to be able to loosen up space for Kelce. But this should not be their typical just spread everybody out, you know, and just try to go bombs away. Because I do think that we know that Fangio will be pretty well prepared to be able to take away a lot of what they like to do under those circumstances.
Well, they've stopped running that Kelce ISO stuff. This is something that I think for the past 2 years.
It's not effective this year, man. It's not effective. It's not effective right now.
So they're like, well, screw it. It's not giving us the looks we want. We're not getting off the ball the way we want to in that formation. So they've just stopped. They have 8 snaps in the last 3 games in that formation. Yep. So like that's something that clearly it's been a focus on them. And like you said, they get him back in the box. Again, we always say this, maybe put Bell in there, two tight ends, and try and run the football, because if any team is not going to give you the looks you want, it's Vic Fangio and his Denver defense. That's for sure.
100%.
All right. This was the Too High Podcast. And remember, if you go on PFF.com right now and put in the promo code Cyber40, you get 40% off in the PFF subscription. grades and data live, and you can read from week 13, and you can read my piece on the Patriots, you can read Deontay's piece on the Colts, and everything else you want to read. So yeah, support the pod, use promo code CYBER40 for 40% off any sub, and we will see you next week. Peace.